Chapter 3. Melville's power in describing and investing with romance scenes, and incidents witnessed and participated in by himself, and his frequent failure of success as an inventor of characters and situations, were early pointed out by his critics. More recently, Mr. Henry S. Salt has drawn the same distinction very carefully in an excellent article contributed to the Scottish Art Review. In a prefatory note to Marty 1849, Melville declares that, as his former books have been received as romance instead of reality, he will now try his hand at pure fiction. Marty may be called a splendid failure. It must have been soon after the completion of Amu that Melville began to study the writings of Sir Thomas Browne. Heretofore our author's style was rough in places, but marvelously simple and direct. Marty is burdened with an over-rich diction, which Melville never entirely outgrew. The scene of this romance, which opens well, is laid in the South Seas, but everything soon becomes overdrawn and fantastical, and the thread of the story loses itself in a mystical allegory. Redburn, apostrophe already mentioned, succeeded Marty in the same year, and was a partial return to the author's earlier style. In White Jacket, or The World in a Man of War 1850, Melville almost regained it. This book has no equal as a picture of life aboard a sailing man of war, the lights and shadows of naval existence being well contrasted. With Moby Dick, or The Whale 1851, Melville reached the topmost notch of his fame. The book represents, to a certain extent, the conflict between the author's earlier and later methods of composition, but the gigantic conception of the white whale, apostrophe as Hawthorne expressed it, permeates the whole work and lifts it bodily into the highest domain of romance. Moby Dick contains an immense amount of information concerning the habits of the whale and the methods of its capture, but this is characteristically introduced in a way not to interfere with the narrative. The chapter entitled Stubb Kills a Whale ranks with the choicest examples of descriptive literature. Moby Dick appeared, and Melville enjoyed to the full the enhanced reputation it brought him. He did not, however, take warning from Marty, apostrophe, but allowed himself to plunge more deeply into the sea of philosophy and fantasy. Pierre, or The Ambiguities, 1852, was published, and there ensued a long series of hostile criticisms, ending with a severe, though impartial, article by Fitz James O'Brien in Putnam's Monthly. About the same time, the whole stock of the author's books was destroyed by fire, keeping them out of print at a critical moment, and public interest, which until then had been on the increase, gradually began to diminish. After this, Mr. Melville contributed several short stories to Putnam's Monthly and Harper's Magazine. Those in the former periodical were collected in a volume as Piazza Tales, 1856, and of these Benito Sereno and The Bell Tower are equal to his best previous efforts. Israel Poeter. His 50 Years of Exile, 1855, first printed as a serial in Putnam's, is an historical romance of the American Revolution, based on the hero's own account of his adventures, as given in a little volume picked up by Mr. Melville at a bookstall. The story is well told, but the book is hardly worthy of the author of Typee. Apostrophe apostrophe The Confidence Man, 1857, his last serious effort in prose fiction, does not seem to require criticism. Mr. Melville's pen had rested for nearly 10 years, when it was again taken up to celebrate the events of the Civil War. Battle pieces and aspects of the war appeared in 1866. Most of these poems originated, according to the author, in an impulse imparted by the fall of Richmond, but they have as subjects all the chief incidents of the struggle. The best of them are the Stone Fleet, apostrophe in the prison pen, the College Colonel, the March to the Sea, apostrophe running the batteries, and Sheridan at Cedar Creek. Some of these had a wide circulation in the press, and were preserved in various anthologies. Clairol, A Poem and Pilgrimage in the Holy Land, 1876, is a long mystical poem requiring, as someone has said, a dictionary, a cyclopedia, and a copy of the Bible for its elucidation. In the two privately printed volumes, the arrangement of which occupied Mr. Melville during his last illness, there are several fine lyrics. The titles of these books are John Marr and Other Sailors, 1888, and Timoleon, 1891. There is no question that Mr. Melville's absorption in philosophical studies was quite as responsible as the failure of his later books for his cessation from literary productiveness. That he sometimes realized the situation will be seen by a passage in Moby Dick. Didn't I tell you so? Said Flask. Yes, you'll soon see this right whale's head hoisted up opposite that Parmacetti's. In good time Flask's saying proved true. As before, the Pequod steeply leaned over towards the sperm whale's head. Now, by the counterpoise of both heads, she regained her own keel, though sorely strained, you may well believe. So, when on one side you hoist in Locke's head, you go over that way. But now, on the other side, hoist in Kant's and you come back again, but in very poor plight. Thus, some minds forever keep trimming boat. Oh, ye foolish! Throw all these thunderheads overboard, and then you will float right and light. Mr. Melville would have been more than mortal if he had been indifferent to his loss of popularity. Yet he seemed contented to preserve an entirely independent attitude, and to trust to the verdict of the future. The smallest amount of activity would have kept him before the public, but his reserve would not permit this. That reinstatement of his reputation cannot be doubted. In the editing of this reissue of Melville's works, I have been much indebted to the scholarly aid of Dr. Titus Munson Cone, whose familiarity with the languages of the Pacific has enabled me to harmonize the spelling of foreign words in Taipei and Amu, though without changing the phonetic method of printing adopted by Mr. Melville. Dr. Cone has also been most helpful with suggestions in other directions. Finally, the delicate fancy of Lafarge has supplemented the immortal pen portrait of the Taipei maiden with a speaking impersonation of her beauty. New York, June, 1892. Taipei, Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.